Coming up in this episode...
This federal project is a really important moment early in the war that begins this transition from slavery to freedom.
And the Army has to decide, okay, so what do we do with these people?
Okay, I know what they do with these people.
You know what they do.
But
so,
tell everybody.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by two of your favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own thoughts and ideas on just what gives these works the narrative edge.
All right, Orlando, I've got a book about the Civil War to tell you about.
Civil War? There are so many books about the Civil War.
I know, but why not one more?
Okay, we've done Civil War podcasts before, but let's hear about this one.
Yeah, we've done the very first episode of this podcast, actually. Listeners should check it out. When you read Ilyan Wu's novel, Master Slave Husband Wife, Civil War adjacent, dealing with slavery, but we haven't done one about the war itself.
Well, it's about time.
It's about time. Yeah, this book is about actually a refugee crisis that the Civil War created. You may have heard of General Sherman's March to the Sea.
The infamous March to the Sea.
The infamous march. Did you know it was a refugee crisis?
Sort of, yeah. They were being followed by the emancipated enslaved people.
I mean, it makes sense when you think about it, right? If you are the Union Army, right, you're liberating people as you go. And if you are a formerly enslaved person with not much to your name and not much protection, you're going to hang out with the people who are protecting you. So that's why they followed them along and, you know, they kind of accumulated along the way.
And that's what we're talking about here in this book.
Yeah, the book is by Bennett Parton, and it's called Somewhere Toward Freedom, Sherman's March and the Story of America's Largest Emancipation.
Who's Bennett Parton, and how is he qualified to tell this story?
He's very qualified. He's an assistant professor of history at Georgia Southern University. This book was his PhD thesis at Yale. David Blight was his professor. You may have heard of that name. He's an incredible biographer. I had the chance to interview him when I worked in New Hampshire about his giant biography of Frederick Douglass. Bennett Parton was a pleasure to talk to. In fact, there's a video of our full conversation. We talked for about almost a half hour or so. You can find that on YouTube. We also link to it at gpb.org/news.
So let's get marching.
Yes.
March to the sea.
Let's get marching. So we know General Sherman marched the Union Army from Atlanta to Savannah in the fall of 1864 toward the end of the Civil War. This is the famous March to the Sea where he burned Atlanta. And that's why Atlanta has the image of the phoenix as its symbol.
Resurgence.
Yes, resurging from the ashes.
The name on the city seal.
So from Atlanta, the army marches southeast to Savannah. Along the way, formerly enslaved people who had escaped their plantations, maybe their plantations were burned or captured or looted, they start following the Union Army and they essentially trail behind them along the way.
So how did they know they were able to follow this army?
Well, there was legal precedent by that point in 1864. Bennett Parton explains that.
It begins in 1861 with a law known as the First Confiscation Act, which treats enslaved people as confiscated property. However, the distinction there is that only enslaved people who claim to have been forced to work for the Confederacy in some capacity were given refuge within the Army's lines. After that, about a year later, more and more enslaved people continue to flee to the Army. This becomes a problem for the Army and also the U.S. government. Congress passes a humdrum bill known as the Second Confiscation Act, which is essentially an Emancipation Declaration. It is Congress's way of saying that enslaved people who come to Army lines are considered thenceforth and forever free.
So essentially, there was an incentive for these folks to hook up with the Army. They were considered free once they did.
So I've heard all kinds of numbers about how many people this march entailed in terms of the number of newly freed enslaved people that were following the Army. How many does he say it was?
Of course, the number grows and shrinks depending on what happens along the way. But by the time they got into Savannah, there's an estimate of about 20,000 formerly enslaved people who were trailing the Army.
This was a problem.
It was a problem in the sense that, you know, these people needed food and sometimes shelter. Most weren't traveling in covered wagons. They were on foot. And we're talking November, December 1864. It's cold, rough times out there. And of course, there were also Confederate troops still in Georgia that could possibly attack the Army and take back these formerly enslaved people. But Benaparten also writes that the Union Army soldiers were in unfamiliar territory, Middle and East Georgia, and the formerly enslaved people knew the landscape better than they did, and they were active participants in the Army's function.
They acted as scouts, as spies, as intelligence agents. They pointed the ways down hidden footpaths. They were able to offer information about where the Confederate cavalry was. The best story is what happens when Sherman's foragers arrive on these plantations and are looking for hidden plantation goods, be it livestock, food, or what have you. Because it's enslaved people who were forced to do some of the hiding of these goods, they knew where all this stuff was. And so they were very, very willing to lead the soldiers out to a corral in the woods or to the family cemetery where trunks were buried. And this gave them real power and real agency in the march.
Parton also says that as they got closer to Savannah, the plantations weren't as bountiful, not as much to loot from them. But the formerly enslaved people taught the army how to husk rice and consume it. And they also served as laborers, which was really an important part for Sherman. He didn't want these people to slow down the army or put the army at greater risk than they otherwise would be. And of course, I don't want to give the impression that Parton describes the Union Army as like 100% saviors of these people. Some among the Union Army were really not welcoming for these folks and did not want them around. Made that clear in a variety of ways, some of which were rather unkind.
Well, we haven't even gotten to Ebenezer Creek yet. Does he get to Ebenezer Creek?
He does write about Ebenezer Creek. So the army's marching along with the formerly enslaved people trailing behind, and one malicious leader of the Union Army ordered the destruction of the bridge over Ebenezer Creek, essentially stranding the formerly enslaved people on the wrong side of the creek as the Confederates were approaching, essentially leaving them to be slaughtered.
Yeah, Ebenezer Creek, just outside Savannah. And you should know that in Savannah, this episode is very well known.
I haven't spent a whole lot of time in Savannah, so this was new to me and particularly horrific. And Parton describes it well in this book.
But it then leads to good things in Savannah. What happened when they got to Savannah?
Well, the army got to Savannah. Obviously, Savannah didn't burn the way Atlanta did. If you've ever been to Savannah, Orlando, we know you have. The city is remarkably well preserved. Sherman famously presented Savannah to Lincoln as a Christmas gift, but the trail of refugees were mostly outside the city limits, and they were put on the sea islands on the coast.
And that's the crisis part.
That is the crisis part, because here you have thousands of people, no connections to the area, no resources, no wealth to speak of, with only as much as they can carry, and they're almost completely dependent on the powers that be. And the army has to decide, okay, so what do we do with these people?
Okay, I know what they do with these people.
You know what they do.
But so, tell everybody.
Okay, so there was divided opinion on what should happen here. And it kind of struck me reading this book that the divide among people back then was kind of similar to how you might expect people, any group of politicos, to divide themselves up today. There were people who said they need to sustain themselves, no help from the government. And then there were people who said they need to ease their way into society by working on land that white people own, but not by force, but for pay. And then there were people who said, let's give them the land, let them work it themselves, create generational wealth, help them when we can, and let them be as self-sustaining and independent as possible.
And there were some experiments to that regard.
Yeah, the Port Royal experiment. This is might be one of the ones you've heard about. This was a big part of the book. Port Royal and experiments like it basically took up the second half of this book.
And we should say Port Royal is in South Carolina.
Port Royal is in South Carolina, right? When we're talking about sea islands, we're not necessarily limited to Georgia here. Here's how Bennett Parton explained the Port Royal experiment.
It begins early in the war in the fall of 1861 when the U.S. Navy sails into Port Royal Sound and seizes the port there. And they do this because Port Royal is the deepest deep water port on the southern coastline. So the idea is if you can establish an outpost there, you can then use that to blockade Savannah and Charleston and use it as a base of command. And so when the Navy sails into Port Royal Sound, they are able to establish this foothold, but it forces the region's white inhabitants, the slaveholders, to take flight. They all evacuate, and they leave behind 10,000 enslaved people on the islands. This is still in 1861, so we are well before this evolution to embrace emancipation takes place. At the time, they are considered contrabands of war, not free people. But the fact that the slaveholders there have all fled, it makes them free in a de facto sense.
The Port Royal experiment essentially was already underway by the time Sherman got there. And it basically becomes more of a federal program funded by a lot of northern charities. Some send money, others come down and create schools, host religious services. administer humanitarian aid of various kinds.
But critically, and this is an important but, they'll also begin coercing, convincing enslaved people to go back to work on the plantations, not as enslaved people, but as wage laborers. And so the Port Royal experiment, this federal project, is a really important moment early in the war that begins this transition from slavery to freedom. And it becomes a kind of model for what emancipation can look like on a much wider scale going forward.
When Sherman arrives, Port Royal becomes the epicenter of the refugee crisis.
Maybe as many as 17,000 people are relocated to the islands from Georgia. These are the Georgia refugees. So this is almost doubles the population overnight. There's a real lack of housing, of space, of resources. Food becomes a problem by March and February. There is a rampant spread of disease. And so as a consequence of Sherman's march and the refugee movement behind his march, and as a consequence of his decision to begin relocating the refugees to Port Royal, this self-contained freedmen's colony, this experiment of sorts, really collapses in on itself.
So what eventually happens to these people?
Well, it's a sad story in my view. Confederates, because they don't pay their federal taxes after they flee when the Union Army advances, that essentially gives the Union legal rights to seize the land and do with it what they want. And there were plans to allocate the land to newly freed people. They want that land too. They want to work. And the land was distributed along the coast in parcels roughly from Wilmington, North Carolina to Jacksonville, Florida. But then Lincoln was assassinated and Andrew Johnson becomes president, and Johnson pardons all the Confederates and takes steps to give them back their land.
I think the number is close to 40,000 families are settled on about 400,000 acres of land by the summer of 1865. And then into 1866, there is a steady chipping away at land claims by formerly enslaved people on the islands.
And of course, history shows us that Reconstruction never fully creates equality and safety for the freed people, despite constitutional amendments. So reading this book, you just got to imagine how much different life could have been for millions of people today had the U.S. government honored their commitment to those freed people back then.
All right. So what gives the book the narrative edge?
So the book is sharp. It has a narrow enough focus so that you can really learn about this specific thing without getting bogged down in the details that historians are more interested in than the general public's interested in. I should say that this book is only about 200 pages. Right, which is gives it the kind of a digestible scope, I feel like, and that narrow focus really helps here. The language is clear. The storytelling is solid. I mean, there is an arc. It's not your traditional American road story, but it is a story. And these people are going from Atlanta to Savannah, and stuff's happening along the way. And we talk about refugees and crises, but this one was right here in Georgia. And he's honest about the government and the military shortcomings and how they handled it. Now, fun fact, too, about this book. This was his PhD thesis, as I mentioned, written during COVID. So that's one way to spend your lockdown, right? Writing about Sherman's march and what it meant for emancipation.
You got to pursue your passion.
Yeah, well, he's clearly passionate about this, really knowledgeable. Fun to talk to. Great book.
Well, the book is Somewhere Toward Freedom, Sherman's March, and the Story of America's Largest Emancipation. Peter, thank you for telling me about it.
Oh, happy to.
Thanks for listening to Narrative Edge. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode. This podcast is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Find us online at gpb.org/narrativeedge.
You can also catch us on the daily GPB News podcast, Georgia Today, for a concise update on the latest news in Georgia. For more on that and all of our podcasts, go to gpb.org/podcasts.